From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're learning more about the man who opened fire inside that gay nightclub in Orlando and killed 49 people. News reports indicate that Omar Mateen had visited the Pulse nightclub before the shooting and that he had used gay dating apps. We'll have more on that in a few minutes. But first, to our own Peter O'Dowd, who is in Orlando and has been reporting on how this attack is affecting the Latino community there. Because, Peter, most of those killed were Latino.
Yeah, Jeremy, I mean, after all, it was Latin music night at the club when the shooting happened, and that is a pretty good reflection of the people who live here. Orlando's Orange County is about 30% Hispanic, and this population isn't really exactly like the population that we might be more familiar with down in Miami. That's more established, it's more historically Cuban. Here in Orlando, it's the largest Puerto Rican population in the state of Florida. It's about 300,000 people. And that Latin connection here was pretty clear as I did my reporting. I caught up with Roxy Santiago. She's with the Human Rights Campaign for Central Florida. And she was busy yesterday at the LGBT Center, like so many people were. She, at one moment, was working with volunteers to get ready for last night's huge vigil.
Thank you for talking to us.
Are you guys going
to
make it down there?
Yeah.
Okay.
So she's, and I told Telemundo about it as well.
And the very next moment, she was soliciting donations.
We are in need of gloves, right? Thank you so much.
Santiago is a woman with tremendous energy in a crisis, her thumbs furiously typing out a request for surgical gloves on Facebook.
Social media has been amazing on getting this stuff.
She laughs, but her heart is broken, so she keeps working. It's easier than confronting a list of victims whose names sound a little too familiar.
It's been a lot. It's incredible. I am also Latin as well as gay, so it's affected me in two different ways.
Each person has been touched in one way or the other.
I also spoke with Maritza Sanz. She runs Latino Leadership. It's a group that offers educational and housing services. After 31 years in Orlando, she has deep ties with fellow Puerto Ricans.
We have other groups as well. We have a community, a Venezuelan community, with all the situation that is happening in Venezuela. We have had a lot of people moving into the area. We have a Cuban community. We have people from Mexico, and we have a lot of people from Colombia.
Now, the news from the last couple of days, how's it impacting your community?
It was a big shock because you watch the TV, you listen to the news, and it's always in another place, but it's never in your own backyard. It was very, very sad.
And not just sad for the city of Orlando, but sad for the Latino community in particular.
It touches, it's our kids, it's our future, it's our families. Each kid has a face of a mom. Every time they were presenting a picture, I was like, oh my God, how that mom has to be, how that family have to be feeling in this moment. People that you know, people that, it touches us.
San says what makes it worse is that many Latinos in Orlando are poor. Some live near the airport and have jobs there. Others work in the city's famous theme parks. Already, she's gotten a call from a woman who's worried about paying for a funeral. She lost a family member in the shooting.
This is going to be financially something that is going to be tough because you're not planning that your son or your daughter dies at 19, 20, 21, 22 when he was okay. So it's going to be a very hard time for a lot of families.
There is a chance that won't be a problem. A GoFundMe campaign for shooting victims and their families has raised more than $3 million. A few blocks down the road, the Bravo Supermarket is a landmark in one of the city's busiest Latin neighborhoods. Nearly everyone I meet here has something to say about the shooting. Alex Ordonez is from Ecuador. He works behind the fish counter.
You know, I a little older than people, but I feel very bad because a lot of Latins go there, supposed to enjoy the night, become the crazy guy, they kill the people. That's very bad.
Do you feel like your community was attacked, the Latino community?
The Latino community right now feels very bad.
Ordonez still feels safe in Orlando, but for Cristina Pena, the shooting hit too close to home.
My kids go over there.
They even go over there because they have friends that go to the club. Thank God they didn't go that day.
Peña is shopping with her elderly mother, Teresa Suarez. She doesn't speak English, but invokes God to make sense of the violence.
Tenemos que amarnos unos a otros, no ser así.
It's terrible because everybody has to love each other no matter what.
Because Suarez says we are all children of the same God.
Somos todos hijos de Dios, el mismo Padre.
For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Orlando.
Well, you've heard that the Pulse shooter, Omar Mateen, had been on the target of FBI investigations and on two terrorism watch lists. And then there are those recent reports that he may have been struggling with his own sexuality. NPR's counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston has some thoughts. Hi, Dina.
Hi.
And start with these reports. Unconfirmed, but there's increasing reporting that Omar Mateen attended the Pulse nightclub for years. He was seen there, you know, may have been on gay dating apps, that there he may have been struggling with his own sexuality. Again, we don't know. These are unconfirmed. And yet you say that if true, this may be part of a familiar pattern to you.
Yes, very much. It's something that we've seen in a lot of the young men who radicalize, going as far back to Al-Qaeda, but also in particular with ISIS. When it comes to ISIS, many of the young men who are leaving for Syria are going for sex. And people who have wanted to go have told police and law enforcement that they were going for sex. Because ISIS promises you a wife and an Islamically permissible way to have sex. You know, Al-Qaeda used to attract misfits, and time and again, we see that those were people who had some sexual issues. Let me just give you one example. There was a young man named Samir Khan. He eventually went to join Al-Qaeda's arm in Yemen. And his imam had told me that he had developed a stutter as he entered puberty. And the imam told me, well, frankly, Samir thinks, you know, every time he sees a girl and has an impure thought, he feels like he's sinning against God. Mm. And this has just been too much for him. And he started to develop this stutter as part of this repression. And not long after this, he departed and left for Yemen. So if, in fact, this latest attack turns out to have some sort of sexual component to it, it wouldn't be surprising at all.
Well, and it's one thing to have what you think are impure thoughts about girls. It's quite another in the fundamentalist faith, the Islamist faith, to have what are seen as impure thoughts about boys. We've seen the footage purporting to show ISIS fighters throwing homosexuals off roofs to kill them.
Exactly. I mean, ISIS is clearly an anti-gay organization, but, you know, they also shoot Shia. Anybody who is not exactly as they are, they level their violence against that group or person.
All right. Well, so we will wait as that reporting unfolds. But one thing that we do know is that he was on a number of terrorist watch lists here in the U.S. Now, that right there, there are different watch lists. We know that one of the Boston bombers, the older brother, was also on a watch list. What does that mean?
There are quite a number of different watch lists, as you say, and whether people are on a watch list is actually classified information. The way we find out about this is, in fact, The Intercept released a classified 166-page rulebook for watch lists a couple of years ago, and that provides some insight on how these lists work. The document was from 2013, which happens to be exactly the time when the FBI was investigating Mateen for some comments that he had made to coworkers that they worried were an indication that he was radicalized. The information about him was probably put into what they call the terrorist screening database. And it's a smaller subset of something else, another list called the TIDE list. And TIDE stands for, and this is a bit of a word jumble, the Terrorist Identities Data Mark Environment List. Mm-hmm. And in the TIDE list, it has classified information. So to share data with other agencies that aren't cleared to seek classified information, they created this smaller database. So it's likely that Mateen was probably in the TSDB, the database, and in the TIDE screening list as well. And he was there about a year. So during the time that the FBI was investigating these allegations that he might have links to terrorism, he was put on those two lists.
Yeah. Well, of course, people now are questioning, how is it that you could have been on a watch list and once the case was cleared, none of that carries over so that you can buy guns, as he did last week. But we also remember that after the San Bernardino shootings, Congress, led by Republicans, blocked a bill that would have denied people still on watch lists the ability to buy guns. Does this mean that if you're on one of those watch lists, you can buy a gun?
It does, because in fact they do not transfer this list over to, for example, the ATF, or it's not among the databases that are checked when you do a background check for purchasing guns. But we should be clear here that Omar Mateen, the shooter in Orlando, was no longer on any of these lists when he bought the guns a week or so ago.
Yeah,
he's been off
saying.
The list for years.
Well, that's what I'm saying. People are outraged that that information somehow doesn't carry over, but we want to underscore that even when you're on the list still, you can still buy a gun.
Yes, and there's some movement on Capitol Hill to try and remedy that situation. It seems like a lot of people believe that that's a reasonable thing to check before you provide someone with a license or an ability to buy a gun.
Dina Temple-Raston, NPR's counterterrorism correspondent. Dina, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Have you heard about The Echo? Maybe been targeted by it. It started on an anti-Semitic podcast that literally makes Jewish names echo ominously. Here's a reference to Bernie Sanders with echoes on his name and echoes of the Holocaust.
And according to a detailed analysis by the Tax Foundation, Bernie Sanders' tax plan would kill 6 million jobs.
Kill 6 million jobs. That echo on the name was translated online into three sets of parentheses on either side of names, names like Jonathan Weissman's. He's the New York Times editor who tweeted out an opinion piece critical of Donald Trump. His name in parentheses came back when he asked, "What is that?" The tweeter responded, "It's a dog whistle, you fool." Another wrote, "Get used to it, you," followed by a derogatory word for Jew. Weissman wrote an article titled "The Nazi Tweets of Trump God Emperor," and then he quit Twitter, saying he'll leave it to the racists, the anti-Semites, and the Bernie bros, followers of Bernie Sanders, who he says attack female reporters. The Anti-Defamation League, an organization that tracks anti-Semitism and hate, is now adding the echo to its database of hate language. But now some Jews are also embracing the echo to take the sting out of it. Jonathan Greenblatt is the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League. Jonathan, start by telling us more about this symbol.
We've been looking at issues of anti-Semitic and racist symbols and iconography literally for decades. Mm. So that it really hasn't changed much, but what has is their ability to deliver it in new, more public and more efficient ways.
Yeah.
And I would say this current spate of harassment against journalists is in some ways an extension of the classic anti-Semitic stereotype of Jews controlling the media. The echo symbol, which seemed to have originated in 2014 on a podcast, it was used to highlight the names of people who were Jewish or perceived to be Jewish, so white supremacists could single them out for harassment, both online and offline. And in the past few weeks, it's gained notoriety because it's been used to target a number of very prominent journalists covering this political campaign.
And including, as we said, Jonathan Weissman, but others as well. And so what happens? People will just tweet out the person's name with the three parentheses on either side?
Yes. So there have been different ways that it has been used. First, white supremacists, anti-Semites, racists, this whole sort of cohort is identifying people who are Jewish or who they think are Jewish, putting the parentheses around them to signal to other users on social media, particularly Twitter, that these people are Jews and should be targeted. And then the individuals receive a deluge of the worst, most indescribable hate. It comes in the form of tweets, you know, basic words. But we see them spewing images, videos, and the harassment, which is often just the kind of prejudicial name-calling you would never do in person, then it has shifted to more worrisome forms of harassment, like, for example, identifying the person's cell phone so others can call the person, identifying their home address, exposing their personal email address. And again, we have seen a number of journalists and other public figures who have been targeted in this way. In addition to tweeting at people or posting on other social media platforms, look, the haters are they adapt and they use new technologies to try to spread their bigotry. For example, some developers created something called the Coincidence Detector, a browser extension for Google Chrome that was available for free through the Chrome Web Store. Extremists were downloading it, attaching it to their browsers, and then whenever their browser would open up a new page, it would take Jewish names or Jewish organizations, or again, those perceived to be Jewish, and putting parentheses around them.
Automatically.
So, automatically.
And by the way, we should say that Google has removed this ability to do an echo with one key swipe.
They did just that. So we at the ADL, for several years now, we've been running a working group with Silicon Valley leaders like Google and Facebook and Twitter, in addition to Microsoft and Yahoo and eBay and a number of others. We've helped them to develop best practices when free speech becomes hate speech and it needs to be dealt with. So we reached out to Google, as did others, when we saw this piece of software. They immediately took it down. We've seen Twitter up their game recently to try to deal with accounts tweeting hate and rape threats and death threats against users like Jonathan Weissman, Julia Yaffe from GQ, Bethany Frankel from The Federalist, and a number of other reporters. But clearly industry needs to do more.
Well, and Jonathan Weissman said Twitter was not responding at all, which is why he quit Twitter. Then he went on to say that Twitter had actually taken down, I think, something like 10 accounts. But it, you know, I always say it's like the replicating brooms in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. You can't stop when social media starts multiplying. How do you feel about the move on the part of some Jews to take the symbol and kind of just make it theirs? Jonathan Weissman, on his Twitter feed, he has both his name and his name in parentheses on each side.
I think it's brilliant the way that some prominent Jewish people on Twitter have tried to do just that, to invert the use of the parentheses and make it a source of pride. Jeffrey Goldberg from The Atlantic started this. A number of other prominent reporters and individuals have used it, including Yair Rosenberg or a number of others. But what's even more interesting, I think, Robin, are non-Jews who are using it. Cornell Brooks, the CEO of the NAACP. Neera Tanden, the head of the Center for American Progress, Matt Duss from the Middle East Center for Peace. Prominent non-Jews are now saying, hey, we stand with American Jews and we will not back down from bigotry. In some ways, it resembles the campaign in Denmark during World War II when King Christian famously pushed back on the Nazis and said, if you're going to make the Jews of my country wear armbands or Jewish stars, we will all wear Jewish stars.
Is this a modern-day burning cross?
I think it is. I think there was a time when the burning cross was this physical symbol that the Ku Klux Klan used to terrorize, in particular, African Americans. But today, when so much of our social interaction happens online, we are banking, we are buying, we are befriending people in social media. I mean, Twitter alone has over a billion messages every day. Facebook has more than 1.6 billion members. And so attacking people online with the parentheses is a digital equivalent to burning a cross or anti-Semitic graffiti or other forms of hate. And I think what we know is that symbols matter. Standing up to them, pushing back to them is critical. I think part of the solution to bad speech is better speech and promoting counter speech initiatives, grassroots efforts. And some of it needs to be a top-down industry response, making sure that not only do these companies communicate their outrage and use their corporate voice, but improve enforcement and create better transparency for their review process. With support from law enforcement and NGOs on the side, I think we can tackle this problem.
Well, but, you know, it's not illegal. I mean, isn't this a free speech issue as well?
It most definitely is not illegal. We are ferocious advocates for the First Amendment at the ADL. We always have been. The challenge is that recognizing sometimes when speech shifts from expressing ideas to terrorizing people, it's something else. Marginalizing and pushing other people out so they cannot express their point of view. And in particular here, what's problematic, and we've seen, Robin, again and again, is when these users target an individual and then that moves from, again, soft harassment online to hard physical harassment offline.
Yeah. As we have been made painfully aware, there are unhinged people who will act out on their hate. Jonathan Greenblatt, what role do you think presidential candidates play in this? Jonathan Weissman was attacked by both Trump followers, Trump trolls, but he also called out Bernie bros.
Robin, I'm really glad you asked that question. We've seen this alt-right movement really kind of emerge during this political season. They are self-styled, self-proclaimed supporters of the Trump campaign, although they have no official relationship as far as I know. And on the left, we saw these Bernie bros emerge as a potent force, maybe without the anti-Semitism, but with the same kind of misogynistic, vicious harassment of reporters and individuals they felt criticized their candidate. We believe at the ADL, we don't endorse candidates, we don't support parties. But I think all responsible public figures, be they elected officials or political candidates, have a responsibility to speak out clearly, cogently, against this type of harassment.
Well, let's see. Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And of course, the effect of hate was on full display in Orlando this week. Today, we heard from some of the doctors at the Orlando Regional Medical Center who were there as the wounded were brought into the ER early Sunday morning. Dr. Chadwick Smith today sat with dozens of medical personnel and one survivor and faced a room packed with the press.
Looking out here today, as crowded as this is about the level of crowdedness that it felt in the emergency department that night. Add in people in pain, people worrying about their loved ones, people not knowing where their loved ones are, and we're trying to help them all.
Obviously, terrible impact on the doctors as well. They expanded the facility's two operating rooms into six to handle the volume they're still operating. Angel Colon survived the shooting by playing dead as the shooter came back and shot him several times. Here he is describing his rescue by a first responder.
He looks at me. He makes sure that I'm alive. And he grabs my hand and he's like, this is the only way that I can take you out. I'm like, please carry me because I'm in pain right now. Couldn't walk or anything. So he starts to drag me out across the street to the Wendy's. And I'm grateful for him, but the floor is just covered in glass. So he's dragging me out while I'm just getting cut.
An emotional Colon told the doctors and nurses who treated him, I will love you guys forever. 27 people are still hospitalized. Six are in intensive care.
Britain's so-called Brexit vote is next week, and a number of polls now show more support for Britain to leave the European Union. A poll funded by The Guardian found Brexit supporters are leading 53% to 47%. BBC economics correspondent Andrew Walker joins us from London. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, what do you make of these new polls? Is public opinion shifting?
That may be the case, yes. And of course, as we get nearer to the vote, more people are going to be making up their minds. But really, I suppose you have to say this. We've had some bad experiences with polls, with elections in recent years, in particular the most recent general election. So I think one does have to take all of this with a good degree of caution.
But as we look at some of the indicators ahead of this, one of them is the value of the British pound against the U.S. dollar. It has fallen to a two-month low. It's about $1.41 for a pound. That is being blamed in part on uncertainty over this vote. What are you looking at in terms of the ramifications, especially if Britain does vote to leave the European Union?
Well, certainly the most exposed financial market is generally thought to be the currency. What you say is perfectly true, although actually sterling is still somewhat higher than it was at the beginning of March and the end of February. But there's no question that what people in the markets are expecting is that a leave vote, if that were to be the result, would see sterling losing value quite significantly.
And just to be clear, what would a Brexit mean for the people who have come into the UK to work from other European countries? I understand from the last conversation I had about this that those who are already there would still be able to stay, but maybe it would affect future immigrants.
That's certainly the most likely scenario. It does depend on negotiations. If there is a leave vote, then sometime after that, the British government would trigger provisions in European treaties for a negotiated withdrawal, and that negotiation would have to make decisions on things like free movement of labour, on trade access. That is all very much uncertain. But yes, certainly many of the leave campaigners have said that people who are already here in the UK would retain the rights that they have had conferred on them.
Andrew, obviously here in this country, we've been spending a lot of time over the last couple of days talking about the attack in Orlando. But I understand that the pro-Brexit campaigners this week released a controversial ad that shows a photo of armed men in a desert believed to be a depiction of ISIS fighters. And it says, act now before we see an Orlando-style atrocity here before too long. How is that playing?
I have to say it's not been absolutely at the front of the debate, but certainly it did draw some adverse comments about whether it was the appropriate kind of language to be using. There have certainly been lots of accusations flying in both directions that the other side have been telling lies. And I have to say what's really unusual about it, of course, is that these accusations are flying backwards and forwards between members of the same political party, in particular the Conservative Party. There is certainly a very, very deep division there. Frankly, it has been there for decades, but it has come out into the open in a rather spectacular way in the last few weeks and months.
That's the BBC's Andrew Walker in London as we wait for the big vote on whether the UK will leave the European Union. That's coming up next week. Andrew, thank you.
It's my pleasure, Jeremy.
One of the youngest victims of the Orlando nightclub shooting was a recent graduate of Laverne High School in Laverne, Tennessee, a suburb southeast of Nashville. He was remembered last night during a tearful vigil. Reporter Tony Gonzalez of Here Now contributor WPLN was there and learned about a joyful life cut short.
Luis Omar Ocasio-Capo, a memorable four-part name. It stood out when he walked across the graduation stage just over a year ago. And to his friends, simply Omar.
Yeah, he was happy with himself. He was outgoing, like, he was very confident.
That's friend Destiny Cruzado.
And he knew, like, his personality brought everyone with joy. And I guess that brought him happiness, to make everyone else smile.
Destiny and Omar were in a group of friends who went together to prom last year.
He was actually the light of everything. Like, the day of prom, I told him if he wasn't at prom, then it just would have been, like, I guess simple. He made everything. He made prom, pretty much.
I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind.
Cruzado was among more than 100 who gathered at sunset in Laverne for words, song, and prayer in memory of Omar. He loved theater and choreographing dance, and he was openly gay, with a confidence about it that empowered those around him, said classmate Ambar Lugo.
He was the type of person, you take me how I am or you don't take me at all. He was happy with himself, and that's something that it rubbed off on you.
He'd moved to Laverne while finishing high school, then to Orlando, where he was a barista, dreaming of a career as a performer. He quickly made friends there as well, including Julius Ortiz, who talked to NPR's Ari Shapiro.
When I was in a very hard situation, because with my dad, and my dad, you know, I was staying with him and he kicked me out. Him staying with his brother and his roommates, he actually took me in for a little. And
he took you in when your dad kicked you out of the house?
Yes. And I mean, like, that's pretty much all I can remember are those times.
Ortiz says he was dancing with Omar on his last night alive. Family friend Samuel Gonzalez back in Laverne said early news of the shooting hit Omar's father with a crushing uncertainty.
But I guess when he heard about it, he was trying to call him and call him. He didn't answer the phone. They called him and they posted a post on Facebook that he was missing. And next thing they knew, it was the third name on that list.
The family, who quickly flew to Orlando, watched last night's vigil via a video call. They heard wishes of support while still making preparations to bury their son today. He was 20. For Here and Now, I'm Tony Gonzalez.
Well, there's pain also in Paris. Last night, a French citizen who'd once been convicted of recruiting jihadists stabbed a police commander to death and posted the attack and pledged his allegiance to ISIS on Facebook. He then killed the officer's wife while their 3-year-old child watched, but was thankfully spared. The Orlando shooter called 911 to pledge allegiance to ISIS in the middle of his rampage. The couple behind the San Bernardino mass shooting also paused and went to Facebook again to pledge their support of ISIS, as did the May 2015 would-be attackers in Garland, Texas, who drove up to that cartoon contest with assault rifles and took to Twitter to pledge their support of ISIS before they were shot and killed. The list goes on. Lone wolves, but with almost a press release. Peter Bergen is vice president of the think tank New America. He's also author of United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Peter, do you think this is a new pattern, pausing mid-attack to pledge allegiance?
Yeah, I mean, one of the kind of outcomes of looking at more than 300 of these cases since 9/11 in the United States was that these attacks are being conducted by American citizens, and they are not working in any real sense with a foreign terrorist organization. They're inspired by these organizations. They will pledge allegiance to them, but they have no formal training or real connections beyond inspiration.
Yeah. And you talk, of course, you have traced this, as you say, since 9/11, but Rachel Maddow on MSNBC did an extensive timeline last night. And she started it in 2014 when the U.S. airstrikes on ISIS in Syria increased, seemed to provoke a reaction from ISIS. They came out with a directive. It seemed somewhat funny at the time. You know, they said, don't come here. Stay where you are. Use a rock. You know, use your car. Use a rock. And people thought, use a rock. And then people started picking up hatchets in New York City or using a car to attack policemen in Canada. Do you think there was a shift then as well?
It shifted in 2015, I would say, with more calls for attacks in the West. Mm. You know, just on May 21st, the spokesman for the group called for attacks in the West in Ramadan. And unfortunately, we've seen both in Paris and Orlando that those instructions were followed by people who had no formal connections to the group but pledged allegiance to them post facto.
And can you trace that pledge to statements from ISIS? Because at that time when they said, don't come here anymore, stay where you are, remember the statements, kill the filthy French. You know, it seemed kind of odd, but then the attacks started happening. And they also said, don't ask our permission, however, pledge to us. I mean, do you think that these attackers are following that mandate?
Yeah, they seem to be.
Yeah, yeah. What else are you seeing in these attacks?
Well, the attack at Orlando, I mean, at New America, myself and our researchers here have put together a database of every jihadist terrorist case since 9/11. And we came to the conclusion that these were not young hotheads typically who were involved in these cases. Their average age was 28. A third of them are married. A third have kids. Not career criminals. And if you look at Omar Mateen, he fits that profile almost perfectly. So do the couple in San Bernardino who killed 14. Mm-hmm. In both cases, they had a kid. They both had stable jobs. In many ways, they were ordinary Americans, except through their adoption of this violent ideology.
And for people who haven't heard it, the new reports are that Omar Mateen, yes, he had a first wife, but he also had a second wife and a child. That news has surfaced. Name one of these events that we might not remember, but we might now see as part of this pattern. For instance, I had forgotten about the guys who pulled up to the sort of cartoon art show in Gardner, Texas. Forgot about that. Name one that you're very much conscious of.
The Garland, Texas attempt to attack the cartoon contest of the Prophet Muhammad is actually a very interesting case because not only were they inspired by ISIS, they were also in encrypted communication with members of ISIS. And so this is an interesting, what law enforcement calls a blended attack, which was both inspired by ISIS and also to some extent directed by ISIS. Now, there's no indication that in Orlando, ISIS directed Omar Mateen to do what he did. But certainly, I think in the future, we're going to see not only inspiration, but also some direction, but not necessarily training, as we saw in Paris and Brussels, where all the perpetrators had actually been trained by ISIS and had gone to Syria.
And what do you think of the reports that Omar Mateen might actually have been struggling with his sexuality? It's almost, terrorism, and we don't know, this hasn't been confirmed, but terrorism as cover for some personal struggle.
There's a wonderful quote from the philosopher Immanuel Kant, which is, from the crooked timber of humanity, not a straight thing is made. And I think that's a good reminder to journalists and historians and sociologists that when we look at people, they're very complex. And on the face of it, somebody may be an Islamist militant. But when you get into it, personal disappointments, it's a mosaic of reasons. And getting to the why is very, very difficult. And in fact, sometimes you never arrive at the why, because at the end, it's inexplicable. Why would you kill 50 complete strangers at a gay nightclub in Orlando? For what end? You've just ruined, 50 families' lives forever. You've wounded a number of other people. But, when you get into the why, you find that there's often a very rich kind of stew of resentments and personal disappointments. Some ideology, of course, that they hang their grievances on to kind of allow them to carry out these murderous acts.
Yeah. Peter Bergen, if I may, we've spoken before. You sound a little weary. I mean, from what you know, I don't know if I'd want to be burdened with what you know, but from what you know, what would you tell officials going forward How do you look for a lone wolf? What do you do?
I mean, there's no way to find a lone wolf really very easily. I mean, the FBI does have investigations in 50 states, 900 investigations. And they are looking at what they call indicators along the pathway to violence. But, you know, lone wolves are not calling foreign terrorist organizations the kinds of communications that can be intercepted by intelligence agencies. They're not also having meetings with co-conspirators, the kinds of meetings that can be monitored by the FBI, and therefore they're hard to detect.
Peter Bergen, Vice President of the think tank New America, and again his book, United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Peter, thanks as always.
Thank you.
We're continuing to follow events in Orlando, but we're also spending some time this week talking about science. And each day, we'll hear from a different scientist in America in a different field about the research they're doing. Gabriela Gonzalez is a physicist working in the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, or LIGO. It's an observatory that in February announced that they had observed gravitational waves for the first time, confirming one of the predictions Albert Einstein made in his general theory of relativity back in 1915. Gabriela Gonzalez joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, very nice to be here.
Well, first of all, explain what gravitational waves are.
Gravitational waves are the ripples in space-time. Einstein's theory of general relativity says that gravity is not a force, but gravity is just the way masses live in a fabric of space-time, and when the masses move, they make that space-time wiggle. And if they move in certain ways, then those wiggles can travel away and carry energy away. And that's what we measured, is those ripples in space-time that were produced by black holes and traveled many, many years, a billion years, to get to Earth and get through Earth.
And I want to play the sound here of two black holes colliding, and the gravitational waves have been converted to sound waves. Now, I'm sure that you are at this point familiar with that sound, but what is it? Explain what's going on there.
First of all, let me say that that was the sound of black holes colliding as registered by the LIGO detectors in last September. However, you played it several times, so We only detected one signal, one of those thumps.
Okay, and that's gravitational waves that we're listening to.
And those are gravitational waves, waves of space-time, ripples in space-time that traveled more than a billion years from the time those black holes collided far, far away until they reached Earth. And when there is a gravitational wave going through, and there are gravitational waves going through us and Earth all the time, when there is one sufficiently big, then we can measure those distances wiggling between the mirrors above the noise that is in general in the detector.
And why would we want to do that?
This has been a dream of many hundreds of people for many decades now. We want to do that, well, first of all, because it's a very cool prediction of Einstein's theory, but that's not worth all the money and time we have invested. It's because it's a way, perhaps the only clean way, to look at black holes and many other stars, many other systems, but black holes in particular.
And why do we need to know? Forgive me for just following you along the logical train here, but why do we need to know about black holes?
Oh, that's fine. We want to know everything about the universe. That's humanity. We are very, very curious. We have been since very early times looking at the sky and trying to understand, what are all those lights? What's the moon? Why does it move that way? And when we learned about black holes from Einstein's theory too, we wanted to know more about those. And now we have a very clean way of seeing how they grow, how big they are, where they are.
And in this case, in order to detect these gravitational waves, and when you talk about LIGO, what we're really talking about are two big, long arms, right? That are, one of them is sort of where you are in Louisiana, and the other one is in the Pacific Northwest.
That's right, in the state of Washington. We make these lasers travel 4 kilometers on each side. That's 2.5 miles, quite a long distance and come back. And when they come back, they interfere, the light beams interfere with each other. And if those two distances are exactly the same, then we measure no light at the output because the light waves cancel each other. But if the distances are just a little bit different, then we will have a little bit of light because the waves will not quite cancel each other.
So what's the next big question that you have that you want to find the answer to through all of this research?
Personally, what I want to see is other kinds of colliding stars. Like when two neutron stars get together, they produce a much, much longer chirp, like the one you played earlier, and then they give birth to a black hole. So you see a black hole just being born.
Why did you want to be a physicist?
Oh, when I was in high school, I fell in love with physics because I thought you could explain absolutely everything if you just knew physics. Now I know that's not true, but that's what attracted me to it. Now I know that for every answer you pose, you find, you get 10 more questions. Mm. But that's what's even more exciting than answering.
That's Gabriela Gonzalez, a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Louisiana State University and the spokesperson for the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's been great being here.
And we'll hear from another scientist in another field tomorrow. You can hear all the stories from our series on science in America at hereandnow.org. Here and Now, production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm learning everything I didn't learn in high school. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.